Welcome. It's good to see each one of you. I'm David Goa, the director of the Ronnie Center, and in partnership with the Kings. It's always good to be reminded this is not one of the British Kings. I think the king it's named for is Norwegian, if I recall correctly. To join with you in furthering our thinking together about a whole range of issues on religion and public life. Ron Nickel has been president of Prison Fellowship International for over 30 years. I remember running into the founder, Mr. Colson, when I was hiding out in the Watergate building just prior to his breaking into it a number of years ago. I shouldn't say these things, should I?
That's okay.
We'll remove these things from the tape. As some of you no doubt know, Prison Fellowship was developed by Charles Colson after his own incarceration in a prison in the United States. And he proceeded to realize the impact of that way of dealing with human beings and seeking to find some way to pull life from these situations. So Ron Nickel has been president of the international organization, there are various national ones as well, for 30 years, and during that time has met with criminal justice officials all over the world, has been in more than 1,000 prisons, which I think gives you a little bit of experience, in 100 countries. He told me earlier today that he spends, did you say 45% of your time on the road? That's almost as much as a National Geographic photographer. Visiting countries, prisons, and working at various levels within those societies. He's also a member of the advisory board of the International Center for Religion and Democracy, or Diplomacy, based in Washington, D.C., and has thought very deeply and talked compellingly about these issues of justice and what we are doing with the prison system. We have brought him here for a variety of reasons, one of which is to have a chance today to engage him in whether or not our justice systems really do justice. He will also be on Saturday at 1 o'clock at Steep's Tea House in a series we have been doing there on crime and punishment. And he will be speaking about the spiritual life within the prison system. Over lunch, he said to me and Rebecca that, in his view, prisons are of the most spiritual places within our society. So, I'm delighted you're here and that you're going to be talking with us. So, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's a delight to be here. Let me just say a few things at the outset. I'm going to be talking about approaching this question of do our justice systems really deliver justice? I'm going to be approaching it through a couple of questions. One is, what is justice? What does justice look like when justice is done? Who doesn't deserve justice? Who are the undeserving? Or justice for the undeserving? Just an outline form, talk a little bit about my own background. Not very long, because it's not something to be belabored. I'm going to be talking about prisons. And my perspective on justice comes by looking at it from the underbelly of the system, which is prison, the underside of justice. Because I think it tells us a lot about the culture of justice that we encounter, and sort of the nature of justice as it is experienced by a lot of people. And then I will be talking about what does justice really look like? What's the purpose or goal of justice? What are some of the outcomes that we should expect when justice is really done? And all of this is predicated on my understanding of justice, which some people call restorative justice. I don't actually believe in restorative justice. I think that marginalizes what justice really is. What we need to be talking about is not either retributive justice or restorative justice, as if those are two options. What we ought to be talking about is, what is justice? What does justice really do? And ultimately, justice is a relationship. Justice isn't an ideology, it's a relationship between people, between society and people, between societies. A little bit about my background. I was born and raised in Alberta, somewhere near the mountains. I am neither a lawyer nor an academic, although I have studied law and I've been engaged in academia to some degree. But I'm approaching this as a practitioner who, as I've said, has seen the underside of the justice system through the prisons of the world. And over the past 35 years, I've been in actually more than 1,000 prisons in about 110 countries. My professional interest in life, my calling, you might say, has been to work for justice for people who would otherwise be not denied justice. Primarily people who are in prison for the wrong reasons or for no reason at all. Initially, I worked with delinquent and neglected kids in Toronto, and then moved to larger responsibility and developing programs for street kids, drug addicts, runaways in various cities in Canada and the United States. In 1983, I joined a small network of organizations in five countries that were an outgrowth of Chuck Colson's experience in the U.S. People read about what he had done and got interested and said, how can we do something like this in our own country? They began small organizations essentially to care for those in prison, to remember those in prison and be engaged with them while they were going through this traumatic experience on the inside. Primarily from a perspective of bringing grace into the context of what was a fairly graceless system. Since then, Prison Fellowship has grown into a global network of organizations in 129 countries representing every region of the world. Our work encompasses services to prison inmates, ex-prisoners, victims, families, and governments, as well as non-governmental organizations. We are a faith-based Christian organization working for the social, physical, spiritual, and moral well-being of prisoners, ex-prisoners, families, and victims. So let me start by giving you a short briefing about the state of prisons in the world, this underbelly of the beast we call justice. There are currently, as far as we know, as far as is documented, just over 12 million people held in over 22,000 prisons, jails, and detention centers around the world. This includes sentenced prisoners, as well as those who are awaiting trial. Roughly half of that 12 million constellation of people is held in three countries, the U.S., Russia, and China. If we divide the number of prisoners by the total population of the world, we discover that 156 out of every 100,000 people are locked up currently. This is called the incarceration rate. It's usually measured by the number of people per 100,000. In terms of national incarceration rates, the United States holds the dubious distinction of being number one in the world by a large margin, 743 people per 100,000 in the general population are locked up. By comparison, the Russian rate is about 500 per 100,000. And in the United States, if we look at adults alone, the number is even more staggering. One out of every 100 adults, that's 1% of the adults in the U.S., are locked up in prison. Even more shocking is the fact that at 1 in 30 men between the ages of 20 and 34 are in prison. And for young black men, the figure is 1 in every 9, so more than 10%. Here in Canada, we take comfort with the fact that our incarceration rate is only 117 per 100,000, which is kind of close to most European averages. But the number on remand, that's people who are in prison or in jail and have not been tried or sentenced, 53%. More than half of the people who are in our jails and prisons have not been sentenced. That compares to 40% just 10 years ago. So the problem is getting worse. And there was a news report this morning about the percentage of Aboriginals who are in prison, the disproportionate percentage. And it's somewhere in the order of 27% of our prison population is Aboriginal, compared to 3%, and I guess it's now 4% of the population. Growing prison populations all over the world have led to overcrowded prisons. This is a fake picture of a prison in Benin that I've visited on a number of occasions. There are over 200 men living in a cell that was originally designed for 12. It's so crowded that they can't all sleep at the same time. The prison in that country operates at 6 times capacity. And this is a problem around the world. A prison in Peru built to hold 2,000 prisoners today holds over 11,000. Prisoners sleep in hallways and in open spaces as well as in the cells. In December, I was in Medellin, Colombia, in a prison that was built for 1,800 inmates, now contains 12,000. Men are forced to sleep in the latrines. And I don't think I've ever seen such inhumanity being done in the name of justice anywhere in the world. Of course, nobody cares. Most of these are paramilitaries and drug dealers from the cartels, enforcers. But the situation comes pretty close to home. The state of California last year was ordered by the courts to release 20,000 inmates in order to reduce prison overcrowding in that state alone. Overcrowded prisons are a multiplier of social problems. They're incubators for disease in many countries, and even in the U.S. One study found that a significant percentage of people with HIV, AIDS, hepatitis C, and tuberculosis have been in prison. Because of overcrowded conditions, lack of sanitation, poor medical care, a prison sentence can very easily become a death sentence in prisons. I was in Zimbabwe 3 years ago, and as I was walking through the central prison in Harare, Zimbabwe, I saw bodies stacked up next to the morgue because the morgue was too overcrowded, bodies and body bags, because of starvation and malnutrition and diseases that they contracted because of malnutrition. Nobody cares. They're prisoners after all. Prisons are also violent places. Last year, we tried to track all of the reported deaths in prison due to riots and gang-related violence. The number was low because not all riots are reported. Not all gang-related killings in prison are reported. And we were also only able to look at English language reports. Nevertheless, we documented over 1,000 deaths due to prison riots and violence in 2012. Gang control of prisons is an enormous problem in some countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico. But actually, no country is immune from gang control in the prisons. We have the problem particularly acute in Manitoba. As a result of the overcrowding, as a result of the culture of violence in many prisoners, there's also a lot of sexual assault. A study done 4 years ago revealed that one out of 20 prisoners in the United States reports having been a victim of sexual violence. Virtually all prisoners, though, are eventually released into society. And so we're faced with a huge question. In what condition do they come back into the community? Do they come into the community, return into the community for better or worse as a result of their experience? Overcrowded and inhumane prisons increase the likelihood of repeat offending. But even apart from that, generally 60 to 75% of the people who are in prison today have either been in prison before or will return to prison within 4 years. The rearrest rate is about 60% rearrest in 4 years, within 4 years of release. And that's true in almost every country of the world. There are a few notable exceptions, Japan being one of them. Imprisonment does not only affect the prisoners. Families are also affected by imprisonment. And this is something that most governments don't recognize, the what we call the collateral damage of imprisonment, particularly on children. Children are often the unseen victims of crime. We estimate that there are currently between 10 and 12 million children with a parent or parents in prison. Children of prisoners have higher rates of delinquency, mental illness, drug abuse, and at the same time, lower levels of school success and later on of unemployment. Some studies have indicated that children of prisoners are 6 to 7 times more likely to become the next generation offenders. This is what I've seen as being the underbelly of our criminal justice system, the tremendous damage done by imprisonment. If we think that justice culminates in a person being tried, sentenced, and put in prison, that justice is done when that sentence is executed, I think we've got it all wrong. Justice doesn't seem to result, but it does seem to result in a certain level of inhumanity, injustice, and certainly tremendous social damage. Churchill said that the mood and temper of the public in regard to the treatment of crime and criminals is one of the most unfailing tests of the civilization of any country. If only you could find it in the heart of every person, the treatment of crime and criminals stored up, or the wealth. I'm sorry, I don't have the quote exactly. I'll leave that part out. Getting my tongue's a little twisted here because I just arrived early this morning. Nelson Mandela said, "It is said that no one truly knows a nation until one has been inside its jails. And a nation should be judged not by it, how it treats its highest citizens, but how it treats its lowest ones." Vivian Stern, a very prominent criminologist in the United Kingdom, describes our use of imprisonment as being a sin against the future. And she wrote a book entitled A Sin Against the Future, in which she very poignantly documents how prisons are a sin against the future. And that prisons are really a magnifying mirror, not just of what's wrong with society, but what's wrong with our way of doing justice. One of the questions I've been asking is, are there people who really don't deserve justice? Or do our societies act as if there are some people in our communities who don't deserve justice? Are there some people who are undeserving? People like the paparazzi who accused Justin Bieber of assault and battery after an altercation with him in the parking lot. The paparazzi don't deserve justice because they had blocked Bieber's car and wouldn't let him leave. Or Karl Rove, President George Bush's chief of staff, did not deserve justice, according to some people who simply didn't like him or like his style or like his politics. And then, of course, there are people like Saddam Hussein who don't deserve justice. And some people think that young men like Omar Khadr don't deserve justice because, after all, they're terrorists or have terrorist connections. But I doubt that too many of us here would seriously argue that certain people or classes of people don't deserve justice. Yet what we find is that some groups commonly don't receive justice. If we look at how justice is done, it appears that a decision has been made, perhaps by default, that some people or groups of people are undeserving of justice. And from what I see in the prisons of the world, the people who are typically denied justice are the poor, the powerless, and those who are considered the pariahs of society, the outcasts who are driven out of society. And they are disproportionately victims within our system. And sometimes there's not a distinct separation between the poor, the powerless, and the pariahs, but that is a characteristic that I see among groups of people who are disproportionately represented in prison. Let me introduce you to some people we've worked with who represent these three groups. I hope that when I'm done, you'll agree with me that all three of these groups who are so often found in prison do deserve justice. First, let's look at the poor. Often they are racial minorities. In some countries, like New Zealand, it would be the Maori. In Canada, it would be the Aboriginals. In the U.S., it would be the African Americans. In Australia, the Aboriginals. In countries like Romania and Hungary, it would be the Roma people, disproportionately represented in prison. Often they're marginalized, socially marginalized. They're undereducated, unemployed, considered unemployable, and certainly unemployed. This is a typical prison in Benin, where chronic overcrowding means that there are too many prisoners for the space available. And most of these are people who are poor, often those who have come from the rural areas of the country trying to find a way of survival by going to the cities, and they can't find work. So they become street people, and they live wherever they can find shelter, and sometimes no shelter at all. They're picked up by the police and imprisoned. Here's another view of a cell with over 200 men, most of them poor, and most of them who are there have not been convicted of a crime, have not been tried. Nearly two-thirds are awaiting trial, and some of them will wait for years before they can even see a judge. And yet, if they were people who had money, they could easily find a way to obtain representation and receive a quick trial. Sometimes there is kind of corruption of this nature in the prisons. You pay somebody off and you can buy a kind of justice. In Benin, we had another problem. The government doesn't have money to take people to trial. And it's reflected in a thing such as simple as transportation, being able to transport somebody from a prison to the courthouse so that they can receive trial. There's no transportation available? Too bad. Unless you're the kind of an inmate who can pay someone to provide that transportation and security. And then on top of that, there aren't enough judges. The record-keeping system is inefficient, and cases simply get lost. I remember going to meet with the Minister of Justice in, I think it was the Central African Republic. And I was there to meet with him concerning a couple of men that I'd met in one prison, wanting to represent them because they were clearly victims of injustice. They'd been discriminated against horribly. So I made an appointment to see him, work my way up through the system. And when I went to his office, in the minister's office were the case files for every single person in the prison. And they were files stacked up against the walls. He could not find the files of the two men that I was asking about. And in all probability, there were no files. The poor are often denied justice in cases like Benin. And so what Prison Fellowship there did was we recruited teams of lawyers in the community to go into prison, to interview inmates, to find out where their cases stood, to find out how long they'd been there, to find out what could be done, what the nature of the charges were, and if there was any evidence, any alibis, anything that they could provide that would help gain their release. So we helped them by explaining the legal process to them and helped them prepare papers so that the next time they go to court, they could be released. They could at least understand what the charges were against them. Poor people, people who are uneducated, who didn't even understand how the system works or what they could do in order to get a fair hearing. In other countries, our affiliates have come up with innovative solutions to some of these problems. In Liberia, we took lawyers into prison to train convicted prisoners, to serve as paralegals for those who are not yet tried, those who are on remand. In Ethiopia and Malaysia, we arranged for judges to go to the prison. They don't have a trial by jury, it's trial by judge. And so we decided to work with government to bring the judges to the prison, much more efficient, so that the inmates could, their cases could be heard. But this is not the only issue that concerns us, the access to legal help or to the court system. It's also education. And so in Benin, we brought in groups of volunteers and recruited volunteers from among the more educated inmates to serve as teachers within the institution, to provide educational and vocational training for the inmates so that they could be upgraded in their skills and their ability to engage the system in their defense. So we brought teachers into prison to conduct relevant classes and also to reduce some of the idleness on the inside that is so destructive. The poor are often denied justice, but so are the powerless. And of course, the poor are among the powerless. But I talked earlier about the children of prisoners. And we find that there are a lot of children who are imprisoned with a parent. This is a young girl that I met and her two siblings. The older girl on the left, I believe, Carmela, in a Bolivian prison, living inside prison with her two siblings, simply because there is no place for them on the outside. And so they are de facto prisoners in that institution, living inside that place with their mother. When her mother was locked up, no one could be found to take care of them, and so they were allowed to live inside the prison. It was horribly overcrowded. It was a women's prison inside a men's prison, and it was pretty dismal. Carmela said that she's often afraid walking through the institution because of how the men look at her. Every time they were allowed out to go to school, Carmela said she hated this because some of the men made her afraid. But then she was also afraid of some of the women. The prison was terrible, but there was no real alternative. And it may seem strange to many of us in North America and certainly in Europe that children would be allowed to live with parents in prison. But in countries where there's no social system, no social support system, there's also very little alternative. And so this is not unusual in Latin America and Africa and in Asia. In fact, in most countries around the world, we do allow infants, babes in arms, to be imprisoned with a parent, even here in Canada, which is okay. It does kind of allow for that maternal bonding between an infant and a child. But as the child grows older, the influence of being in a prison with adults is devastating. No one knows how many children live in prison with parents, but we conservatively estimate that there are between 10 and 15,000 children in prison today. There could be many more. They are victims, they are powerless, and they suffer injustice at the hands of the justice system. Bolivia has a very unusual system where prisoners can purchase cells. This goes back to the idea that the people who have the resources can buy justice. Well, they can also buy amenities in the prison. So if you need more space and you have the money, you can purchase a cell for yourself so you don't have to be in an overcrowded situation. But think of the impact of that type of climate on the people who are powerless and who are poor. But we were able to take advantage of that and buy a couple of cells to provide places of refuge for kids inside the prison, where they can study, where they can play, and where they can be fed nutritious meals. Prison Fellowship in Nepal has rescued a lot of children out of prison, and they have created what they call precious children's homes. Three of them across the country, where children who would otherwise be in prison or on the street are given a safe place to live, assistance with their education, and loving care until their parents are released. And in some cases, we're able to reunite them with a parent. In a lot of cases, we're not. And so we are now providing for them through high school and into professional training or technical training, whatever works for them. So those are two groups who are often denied justice, the poor and the powerless. What about pariahs? Those who, because of what they have done, have placed themselves outside of society's norms. I'm thinking about those who, in fact, committed crimes, not just of those who have committed crimes, but those who have committed terrible crimes. Rwanda is one example of a country where we've become involved significantly. In 1994, after a four-month period, nearly a million people were slaughtered, killed by their neighbors. This was the result of an uprising orchestrated by Hutu leaders targeting the Tutsis, minority ethnic group. Many governmental, business, and even religious leaders became complicit in the resulting genocide. Shortly after the violence ended, a national unity government was formed, and I was invited by government and civic leaders to participate in a consultation on national reconciliation. They had more than 115,000 Hutu prisoners, people who were complicit in the genocide in their institution. I mean, it was horrible. The national stadium had been converted into a prison camp. Not enough water facility, not enough food. It was just tremendous congestion, and nobody knew what to do with them. These were pariahs of the society. They had killed their neighbors. They had turned against their own family members who were considered Tutsi. And it was an awful situation, but the National Unity Government wanted to see if we can't deliver justice to these people in the sense of trying each one of them individually in the normal court system. So how can we do justice in a way that restores the dignity of this country, that restores the fabric of this country, and yet holds people to account for their misdeeds? Worked with them as they selected a process called the Gachacha court system, similar to a truth and reconciliation process, modeled after South Africa, but something that was more rooted in their traditional way of doing justice, which simply meant that if a perpetrator or an offender came forward and told the truth about his or her involvement in a criminal offense, or in this case, in the genocide, And if they told it in a way that seemed to come from the heart, a discourse could be established between the individual perpetrator, the victims, the surviving victims, and the community, and together they could decide what that person should do or what could be done to address the terrible damage. The approach attempted not only to determine responsibility for harm that had been caused in the community, but it also sought a response that would repair the harm and strengthen the community. Indigenous courts like this do not follow the Western assumptions about justice. Most of these prisoners had denied any involvement in the genocide because they expected that they would be tried in a Western-style court and that they would be executed. The Gacaca courts are much more relational and local and conversational in nature. The advantage is that they help the community move towards healing and reconciliation. But they also require honest conversation, truth-telling, and a willingness to work toward a common resolution. Truth-telling was particularly important for the genocide widows and their survivors. Many of them had not only seen family members killed before their eyes, but they themselves suffered gang rape and mutilation and had been left to die, even though they survived. Many acquired AIDS in the process of the rapes. Now, as the government took steps to release large numbers of these 115,000 perpetrators into the community, many of these survivors understood why it was necessary. But one victim said, "It would be so much easier if they would just confess what they've done. All we want in order to come to terms with what's done, have them take responsibility, have them admit their fault, their complicity." So together with the government, we began a reconciliation project, victim-offender reconciliation project, known as the Umuvumu Tree. Umuvumu Tree is a typical tree in the villages, in the communities, under which the village elders used to meet together to resolve community issues. If somebody had a dispute with their neighbor, they would come together to this Umuvumu Tree, sit together with the elders, and they would work out a solution, an arbitrated settlement. The Umuvumu Tree project began in the prisons, where we invited inmates to come and tell the truth, to share their experience. And we did the same thing in the community, urging victims to come together, talk about their experience of victimization, talk about the pain, talk about their frustration. And then after a time, we brought small groups together so that the victims could hear from the offenders and the offenders could hear from the victims. And in that process, there was a tremendous release. A burden was lifted from the victims, from the offenders, and from the community. And we were able to talk about, now what can we do? As a result of the process, and I could tell you a lot of stories about it, but in Rwanda now there are three or four places called reconciliation villages where the victims live together with the offenders. The offenders have built the houses as a way of reparation toward the victims. I mean, they can never obviously give back the life of someone that they took, but they can somehow restore the well-being of the family in some way. And one way is by building these homes for the surviving victims. And then work to rebuild the economic fabric of the community as well through cooperatives, working together in agricultural and small manufacturing jobs to restore the economic well-being of the community. Tens of thousands of prisoners participated in this process. In the first 6 months, the number of prisoners who made public confessions grew from about 5,000 to 35,000. And one of the key questions prisoners discussed was how to make amends for their participation, and that's where we came up with this idea of the reconciliation villages. They were able to tell what happened in spite of considerable pressure from other genocide participants. But in a normal system, these pariahs of society would have simply been summarily tried and executed, and society would be worse off. the damage that was done, the hurt that was done, the tremendous trauma would never be healed because the offender would simply be gone and the victim would not have come to terms with the with what happened to them. So they took symbolic, tangible steps to help genocide survivors, such as building those homes. They understood that it would be an injustice to ignore the victims. So justice brings restoration by seeking to repair the harm caused by crime. Not all situations, though, are like Rwanda. There are many pariahs in society. Think about the pariahs in our own communities. Drug dealers. In the United States, it's illegal immigrants. These are considered pariahs, people who are taking advantage of the country by coming there illegally, getting jobs, and sending the money back to Mexico or Guatemala or wherever it may be. And so they are targets for the justice system. They're targets of society. And they don't receive justice. Or think about street people. The racial profiling that goes on in many communities. Or think about ex-prisoners. If you have any record at all of having committed a crime or having been in prison, you are an automatic target for future engagement with the law enforcement system and the justice system. And you don't get a fair shake. What is justice? Well, all of this leads me to the final part of my talk. What do we mean when we speak of justice? What is justice? And what does justice look like when justice is done? We can give conceptual answers to the question. In one sense, justice is about fairness. Justice is the golden mean. Justice is something to do with proportionality. So that if you have hurt somebody, somehow justice is done when you are punished in a way that represents a proportional pain or a proportional loss for yourself, and so on. These are helpful ways of looking at justice, but in the end I find them all rather abstract, and justice is not an abstraction. Justice is a verb. Justice is a relationship between people. Justice is a relationship between society and the victim, between society and the offender. And all people, regardless of whether they seem to be deserving or undeserving, whether they're poor or powerless or pariahs. Recently, I began thinking about justice in terms of the ecology of justice. Again, especially in relationship to the use of imprisonment. If the imprisonment of offenders represents a satisfactory outcome or means of bringing justice to completion, then it is helpful to consider the ecological impact of prisoners in regards to, in terms of social ecology, in terms of moral ecology, in terms of economics, public well-being, and so on. Just looking at the social ecology, if we think that justice is being done, that harm is being repaired, that community well-being is being restored, when somebody has been sent to prison, we're wrong, because 75% of the people come back to commit further crimes. So it's an ecological disaster. The problem is only multiplied or deferred. Think of the moral ecology. Does it make any sense? I mean, this prison just has always seemed to me to be the most counterintuitive system in the world, the most illogical system in the world. We think that someone who has committed a crime, a person who has made bad moral choices, that by putting such a person in prison with other people who have made bad moral choices, that that's going to help them get better? That that's going to help society? It just does not make any sense whatsoever, because the dominant influence comes from a value system that is just as negative, just as antisocial as the person who's being sent in. No wonder we sometimes refer to prisons as being universities for crime. It doesn't make any sense to say somebody has been irresponsible in their use of freedom in society. And the way we're going to deal with that is to take all freedom away, take all responsibility away, put you in an institution, by putting you into an institution, and then 4 years later, 5 years later, you come out, and you're going to be more responsible with your freedom when you haven't had any opportunity to exercise responsible decision-making in a free situation during the intervening time. It doesn't make any sense. And somehow that's part of our justice system. And I'm not a prison abolitionist. I'm not anti-prison at all. Because I think for the protection of society, there are people who need to be incapacitated in that way. But we put far too many people in prison. The majority of people who are in prison in this country today are not there for violent offenses. They are not that kind of a danger. They do not represent that kind of a danger to the community. But it's a convenient way of putting some consequence on people who have offended so that they feel punished, or that the community feels that they've been punished, that they get their just deserts. But that's about all. We don't repair the damage that was done. And then the economic ecology. Not only does it cost $360 a day in Canada to keep a person in prison, $360 per day. And that's not to count the capital cost of building institutions and maintaining those institutions. This is just the cost of maintaining someone in prison. The cost of accommodation, the food, the water, those sorts of things, the custodial costs or the security costs. And then when these folks come out of prison, they're unemployed, unemployable. Many of them have no place to live. You factor in the social consequence, the cost of maintaining their family when they're in prison, usually borne by the state, by the government, through social programs like welfare and other types of assistance. The cost of imprisonment is enormous. It's just a bad investment. We have to look at justice through a larger question. What does justice do? How is justice made relevant to all people? The poor, the powerless, the pariahs. How does justice really repair the damage and heal the hurt and restore community well-being? Because, as I said earlier, justice is a relationship. And injustice or offending behavior does damage to the relationships within a community. And it would seem to me that justice is about setting things right, repairing the damage, restoring relationships. How do we do that? It isn't done by imprisonment. Let's look at some of the actions of justice. One is justice rescues. Justice brings relief to those who are oppressed. Sometimes we're better able to understand something when we consider its opposite. In the case of justice, one aspect of the opposite of justice is injustice, which is the abuse of power. The remedy to the abuse of power, and this is not just abuse of power by the government, could be abuse of power by anyone who victimizes another person. The remedy is to protect and free the ones who are being victimized, who are being bullied by the person or system or institution that has power over them. So one responsibility or one action of justice is to rescue people who are victims of the abuse of power. Another aspect of justice, another action of justice, is that it does ensure that people take responsibility. There's a day of reckoning, a point at which things converge and the offender is brought to account for what they have done. Justice holds wrongdoers responsible, and in so doing, in a sense, provides vindication of the law and of the victim. the truth will come out. The idea here is not so much revenge in terms of day of reckoning, but accountability and responsibility. And as I've talked to victims around the world, more than anything, what they want to do is they simply want the truth to be told. They want the person who did the act against them to take responsibility for what they did. And that often doesn't happen in our court systems or the way we do our justice procedures. But this typically should come within the context of an official proceeding in which guilt is determined and consequences are determined. And consequences that aren't just punitive, but consequences, as in Rwanda, that are reparative, that are reconciliatory, that are restitutional, so that would create a more a situation of closure and healing. Another action of justice is restoration. The purpose of justice is to bring about restoration. Repair, as I've already said, repair the harm caused by injustice. From this perspective, the injustice to be confronted is the fact that most of the time victims are ignored. They're left out of the process. Maybe by way of a victim impact statement, they would have some engagement. But most of the time, the justice process is it's a state. It's the crown against the individual. It's not about trying to figure out what happened between the offender and the victim. And so the victim is left out. Justice that restores would include restitution as a victim-oriented sanction instead of imprisonment. Certainly when compared to imprisonment or the treatment of offenders, some sort of symbolic restitution or real restitution would be very helpful. Victims and communities often suffer more than material harm, however. Crime causes relational harm. It shatters the semblance of peace and security in the community. There's fear in the community as the result of crime. So an approach to justice that concerns itself with restoring the well-being of the community would provide for victim-offender meetings, perhaps, or some engagement between the offender and the community, so that the community can also be part of the process and come to closure and satisfaction in terms of the damage that's been done. When justice is done, justice sets things right. It changes people, it changes structures so that they are better than they were. It would be unjust to leave people or situations, abusive people, abusive situations as they are. So it calls for a reformation of systems where systems are what is are causing or propelling people into offending behavior. Justice calls us to work for the reform of systems and the rehabilitation and healing of people. So the actions of justice are about rescuing those who are victimized. It's about holding the offender to account, holding them responsible. It's about restoration, and it's about setting things right. That's what justice looks like when justice is done. And when we think about justice in this context of maybe the etymology of the word justice comes from justification. It's about restoring the balance, bringing things back into harmony, because offending behavior upsets the balance. It upsets the equilibrium, the well-being, not only between the offender and the victim, but within the community. And justice would seek to justify, bring things back into harmony, into a state of well-being. Maybe we could call that peacemaking, that part of justice is about making peace, restoring peace. In the I guess when I was growing up, police officers were often referred to as officers of the peace. There was a reason for that. That part of the job of police officers, part of the job of policing a community, was not about apprehending offenders or having the effect of scaring people to the point that, oh, I might be caught, so I won't do something. But they had the authority to engage with the community, with victims and offenders, to bring about peace, to seek peace, to restore a situation of dis-ease within the community. Magistrates and judges were sometimes called not officers of the peace, but they were called
justices
of the peace. Justices of the peace. And that also connotes that idea that part of the judicial process was to bring about peace within the community, peace within a situation that had been disrupted. So justice sets things right. When I look at the prisons of the world, when I look at our own prisons, when I look at the underbelly of the justice system, which is represented by prisons, we're not doing justice. We are creating a problem, and I think it is, as Vivian Stern said, it's a sin against the future. How we currently do justice, at least insofar as our prison systems are concerned, isn't really justice. It's a sin against the future, and only multiplies and perpetuates a huge problem in our society, and in fact does not lead us to becoming a more peaceful society than we were. Any comments, questions? I'd be open to having a conversation about this. Any aspect of this, domestically, internationally?
Different times, different lives.
Absolutely right. And I think that's, if it's true that, for example, if it's true that the children of offenders are 6 to 7 times more likely to become next generation of offenders, we have to look at why is that. And very often we find it is because they have already been victimized. I find that many of them are sexually victimized. They're certainly victimized as a result of being marginalized in the society. Now, don't associate with that kid because you know what, you know where his father is, that kind of thing. They're victimized because of their access to the normalizing benefits of the community don't accrue to them in the same way. And so there are some very visible ways in which they're victimized and some much less visible ways. And they become the next generation offenders. I find, for example, working with female offenders, that the vast majority of them have been sexually abused. The vast majority. And that is becoming increasingly true within the males as well. That there has been a traumatic experience of victimization. Not only sexually, but in many other respects. They've been bullied. So yes, we have our justice systems, not deliberately, but de facto kind of blame the victim. We're not recognizing and it's becoming more true than ever when in a situation where the government is imposing kind of standard sentencing and sentencing guidelines that don't allow the judges the same discretion as they used to have to take into account the social factors, the milieu in which this has taken place, and the life of the offender. So you can't take that into account. You have to treat them as a person who's committed a crime without any other consideration. That we blame the victim.
I was interested in the use of the word justice at various points in your talk, because if you ask the question, who deserves justice, You know, your person on the street will say, well, that criminal deserves justice. What they mean by that is that criminal deserves punishment. But at the same time, you ask the question, who deserves justice? And you're saying, well, the victim deserves justice. And that means something else. So we've got one word that seems to kind of cover a variety of meanings. How do we get that sorted out, or do we need to have a more complex system of words?
I think we just simply have to understand what does justice mean.
Okay, so justice, right,
what does justice mean for the victim? What does justice mean for the offender? What does justice mean for the community? Mm-hmm. What does justice mean for the families? Affected, you know, part of the community as well, but more specifically, they are affected by crime and by whether it's on the side of the perpetrator or the victim. How do we repair the damage there? I think justice is about holding the offender to account, and that there has to be a consequence. Reparation has to be made in some way. Not just through imprisonment. That justice is done by somehow restoring the well-being and repaying the damage to the victim. Justice is done when the community is made a better place, a more peaceful place. So I think that is all underneath the rubric of justice. But you're right, very often we think justice is the punishment of the offender, and that's where we get it all wrong. That's driven by the way media approaches justice. I think often it's also done by the way churches think about justice. We have an Old Testament view of justice that is very retributive, very punitive, and that's the image that we carry in our minds and project it to society. And that's simply not what justice is. In fact, if you look at justice theologically, the words justice and righteousness are actually interchangeable. And it has to do with both that inner well-being and the social well-being. The inner well-being being your values, your relationship with God is in a peaceful state, in a state of well-being, but that also emanates into your social relationships. So at the end of it all, justice is a relationship, and it's a holistic relationship.
Of course, that's all through the Old Testament. Well,
it is throughout the Old Testament, but our selective reading...
And how do you...
We're an illiterate people, aren't we, when it comes to understanding the richness of a term like justice. We operate on these paradigms that come from fear, that come from anger against crime, that come from that are driven by a society that really does want to live in peace, and yet the way we think living in peace is accomplished is to get the people out of sight and out of mind. And we don't think about the fact that they eventually come back, and we reap a whirlwind in a way. So I think that we are, and maybe particularly in the evangelical community, I don't know, we're illiterate when it comes to these rich concepts of justice.
How would you see justice for a drug dealer? Often they don't.
Yeah, that gets a little more difficult. We've had some success in a program we call the Sycamore Tree Project, where we take drug dealers, or you know, whether they're big time drug dealers or small time drug dealers, and bring them together with victims, often the parent of a child that has died because of a drug overdose, or a child that is severely damaged because of drug use, and allow them to tell their story. Because sometimes drug dealers think, well, I'm just supplying a demand here. I'm responding to the demand. It's not my problem. The kid has the problem, and I'm just responding to that. I'm just I'm just doing this.
Well, clients are adults and making bad decisions, and that's how they justify.
That's another way to look at it. But often it is where we do find some currency with in the conversation with drug dealers is to have them look at the consequences in a child or a young person. I don't mean a small child, but a teenager or a young adult. But to hear the parent tell the story and how deeply it has hurt them often is a wake-up to these offenders. And we've had some amazing conversations between drug dealers and parents of kids who have OD'd and died or who've been severely disabled as a result. And they say, well, I really never knew it. And they see it up close and personal. And to hear the story, to see the parent, very often has an impact on them. That's one of the tough ones. Yeah, and a lot of times too, there are people. We're talking a little bit about victims. In a sense, they're victims because, in some instances, they were marginalized, and they had no way of moving forward economically in their own lives, other than doing something like drug dealing, which becomes very attractive to a kid, who grows up on the poor streets or the poor side of town, or who doesn't have an education. Is unemployed, and now there's a way forward for success. But there's a lot of hurt behind that.
Yeah. The economic issue is, I think, is just too narrow.
It's one of the definitions you put forward.
No, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Something to do.
You know, I used to hold up Canada as being a shining example. And it was considered one of the premier criminal justice systems in the world. Canada has had a huge impact in criminal justice globally until about 10 years ago, maybe less than that. When we turned, we were going down a very clear course on restorative justice, invested a lot of money on restorative justice, on keeping people out of prison and treating them within the community. A considerable amount of money on rehabilitation programs on the inside, education on the inside, spiritual life on the inside of prison. And little by little, that's all being stripped away, ostensibly for economic reasons, but it has devastating consequences. And I can't hold up Canada any longer as a shining example, but it once was. Now, apart from, and Canada invested money in the creation of the International Prison Chaplains Association. When that organization was founded, it was funded by the Canadian government. The International ICPA, International Criminal Justice Professionals Association, was also something that came out of the Canadian government and has had a huge impact globally. Both of these organizations are no longer have any connection with the Canadian government or any funding from that, but we had a great influence, and people respected Canada. Even the things such as the mission statement of Corrections Canada was all about not only protecting the community but restoring the offender back into responsibility within society. That was the mandate of correctional services. And that infected criminal justice systems all over the world. I see our mission statement written here in Canada. I see that in correctional mission statements all over Africa today because of what we did here. But I think we've taken a lot of steps backwards.
And you will go lobby and keep applying. Can you go back?
I wish we could go back. I don't see any light right now, but we hold up as a negative example what was done in the U.S., where you had this massive prison construction, ideology such as three strikes you're out, mandatory minimum sentencing, no judicial discretion at all, and that's the direction in which the Canadian government is moving. It was proven to be totally wrongheaded in the U.S. We have brought people to Parliament to testify, folks from the U.S. who were part of the system, including senators and criminal justice officials, but it falls on deaf ears. Yes, it's a problem of the community, and I think we have to change the conversation in our community, because government will respond to community. And if this is what if the people of Canada want justice in the way that we were talking about justice, then I think there will be some movement in that direction. But right now, we are becoming like much of the rest of the world, which is just, you know, lock them up, throw the key away, get tough on crime. Even though we are living in a country where the crime rates are not really increasing that significantly.
So can I come back to Rob's question?
Well, a couple of influences. I don't think we can discount the enormous influence and impact of Chuck Colson. Mm-hmm. He was a man of impeccable, until he went to prison, Republican credentials. So the conservative, lock him up, throw the key away, get tough on crime, a law and order mentality. In fact, Chuck said that he wrote some of President Nixon's toughest law and order speeches. So he had those credentials. He was an unusual Republican on the one hand, conservative evangelical Christian as well, who could speak with credibility on, is there a better way to do justice because of his own experience? So he could, on the one hand, talk about the need for responsibility and for law and order, but at the same time, with credibility, say there's got to be a better way of accomplishing this because this isn't working. So I think as a spokesperson, he created new ground for us, at least created new ground for prison fellowship in the U.S. As in my role with the international community, I've had a lot more freedom to pursue the kind of agenda that we've been talking about today, largely because I'm not dependent on individual donors. We're a membership-funded organization. Each one of the 129 national organizations contributes a 6% fee. And so we're funded that way. We don't have the pressure from individual donors who might not agree with this agenda. Now, we are facing incredible pressure from the American organization, who think that that we've gone into social justice. And so we're working through that, and that's a concern. Yeah, sure. And then that was
just elaborate on
that. Was another thing that has helped us, mm-hmm. has helped us break through. The hidden victims of crimes, I've said, are the kids of offenders. Nobody thinks about what happens to the children of prisoners. And yet everybody has compassion for children, you know, innocent victims. And when you talk about the children of prisoners being the innocent victims of crime, whose future is being bankrupted because of not only what's happened to a parent, but because of the fact that they're now orphaned in a way. They're alone. They're forgotten at Christmas of all times. Think about these kids. And as we've got conservative people to think about the children of prisoners, it's opened a window for us to have the larger conversation. Mm-hmm. And this window in talking about the children of prisoners has also been a way of engaging them economically, mm-hmm. because of that compassion for the innocent children.
I disagree with
that. We're looking, for the last year we've had this project in the organization, trying to come up with an irresistible proposition on justice. Irresistible, at least, within the faith community. Something that just makes such compelling sense that you can't avoid it. But how do you get it down into three, four words that are memorable and that connect with with what people want.
Thanks so much.